Fraser at three.
Yeah. One of the things that that we did there was we rescued from Amalfi a fellow called Benedetto Croce, who was supposed to be a great Italian philosopher, and his wife and his daughter. But it took two attempts to do it. Now, this is very funny. Amalfi is actually between Naples and Salerno. But it was occupied at that time by the Germans, so we had kind of gone round it to get up to Naples, so it meant going back. Anyway, we used one of the American patrol boats, multi-torpedo boats. And guess who was the, what is it, the skipper of that flipping thing? Douglas Fairbanks Jr. He was a skipper. Anyway, it took two attempts to get it.
Can you just give some more details about what happened?
No, they just run in and they took him down back past Capri and back into Naples. That's all there was. It was as easy as anything. It was German occupied, all that part there. And we never saw anything. Nothing at all. And his wife wouldn't go. So they had to go back the following night and go and get her. I didn't go the following night.
What kind of impression did Croce make on you?
I can't remember the fella. I know it was an old fella. I've tried to picture it since, you know, when I got told who it was, you know, I never knew until a few years ago who it was.
Was he decrepit?
Pardon?
Was he decrepit?
No, anyway, well, you know, at that time, anybody a 50-year-old was a bloody old fella. You know, I couldn't say. You know how it is. Like, as I say, you know, when you're 18, 19-year-old, you get a fellow 50-year-old, an old fella, right, you know. And if anybody class me as an old fella, I'm nearly 70, you know. I crack on one, but, you know, he looked all right. He looked all right. Now, what else was I going to say? Oh, yes. There was another fella called... A lot of these officers that we had at Naples didn't go under their true name. I don't know why. They all have different names. It's like the fella that I will eventually tell you about. I went on operation with him. Hedley Vincent. He went under the name of Tucker. Now, there are one there called Rushton. Now, I do believe that his proper name is Renton. Whether it's the fella... And I do believe he was a member of Parliament, but he can't be that one that I know that was the QC. I don't think it could be him, because I think he's a bit too young, but he could play the piano, I know that. A really marvellous pianist. But we had all kinds of people there with us, staying at that house in Naples, quite an important house. And...
Which month have we reached now?
Pardon?
Which month have we reached now?
What month? Now, the armistice was in September. August, September. It'd be October, November. They then decided to run a training school for the Italians. They must have had a good idea that things were going to go a bit of stalemate. Whether Cassino had appeared on the scene or what, I don't know. There was a true stalemate there. The war in Italy lasted a heck of a long while, if you can, you read the book. Whether they knew this or what, I don't know. Whether it was just to keep the Germans occupied while they started the Second Front or what, I don't know. But they decided they would have a training school, and they thought they'd go for one on an island next to Capri, which is the, although everybody goes to the Isle of Capri on their holiday, the nicest one is the one next to it, which is the Isle of Ischia. And they had one there, and I was sent over there, along with Dinaro that we picked up in Sicily, and one or two more. And we took over a house just outside a place called Lacamino. And it was called Mezzatore, and it belonged to the Count de Fasano. So they said at the particular time, beautiful, on the headland. And I remember later on using some of the plastic explosive to provide the fish course at meal. I used to just whiz it off the end and the fish would come to the top and that. But we had a brilliant one with it there. We kept having a naval commander come, a bloke called Simpson. He was a bit of a weirdo. He used to run up the coast of Italy with these people that we'd trained. We had a couple of Italian anti-submarine boats. And apparently Gallegos was on one of these when he was when he hit a mine or something like that. And he finished up in a concentration camp for a prisoner of war in Germany. And then got out of the prisoner of war camp and walked it all back. And apparently he's written a book from Capri to Oblivion or something like that it's called. Andres Gallegos, he wrote about it. He used these Italian submarine boats. They call them Mass Motor Antisigillante. Marvellous they were. The Italian army and all the mechanized divisions were rubbish, but the motorboats and their aeroplanes are really fantastic. This one, I think it could outpace anything that we had. For me, especially for the Mediterranean, not for the Atlantic, you know. The two blinking big Fiat engines in, they were fantastic boats they were. We used to fly between this thing up the coast, up to Gaeta and Nettuno, around that area where they eventually did a landing. And then across back, many a time back into Naples. We used to keep them. I always remember the little port right in the centre of Naples there, Sant'Angelo, I think it was called, Porto di Sant'Angelo or something like that. It was lovely there. Great, fantastic. And I love those motor submarines, the motorboats are really, really fantastic. They're going to have plow through the water. Anyway, this we run a bit of a training camp there, and then from there we're getting on then to the armistice will be September 43. So at the beginning of 1944, this Hedley Vincent asked me to come down and join him down in South Italy, as he wanted to run an expedition up North Italy, and he'd like me to go with him. And we went down to Monopoly, went further down. Just let me try and think of what the name of the place was. The place was San Vito de Normani in Puglia, in South Italy. We did a lot of training with explosives. They had some old railway lines there. We had to do it blowing them things up. And I forgot to say that beforehand I had I had taken a parachute course down at Brindisi. I had, at the training school. I forgot to have mentioned that. So I was a fully fledged parachutist at that time. The training school, I'll leave the San Vito Normani and I'll go back to the training school, the parachute training school. Because it's very, very interesting. There was a fellow run that called Jumbo Newman. And at one time, Mac Donnell, he was an instructor there in the parachute. Now, the types of plane they used, instead of using our own, they had some Dakotas, but they used a lot of the Italian, the Savoia Machetti 82. Now, a Savoia Machetti 82 looked something like the Dornier 52, but instead of having three, it had two motors. But the bodywork, instead of being a metal bodywork, it's a canvas bodywork. And these things, they couldn't pull the skin off a rice pudding. We'd go along the runway at Brindisi there, and it'd pull up with a screech at the end. It couldn't lift the tail off the couldn't lift the tail up to take off. Everybody had to crowd to the front of the flipping plane before it would take off. And this is what we were parachuting ourselves. Not only were the army blokes like myself, but there were Joes and Italian women. And there were one Italian woman there who seemed to be, she wasn't in training, she seemed to be a camp follower, if you understand what I mean, what a camp follower is. And she was called Fiametta. And every parachute, every time that plane took off, Fiametta was on it and she made a jump. She must have made bloody hundreds of jumps. She'd do at least 20 a day. And I am to mention this to an Italian friend of mine who I go and see every year. I've done for the past 30 years. And he said, one time he told me, he said, yeah. He says she was featured in in cartoon articles after the war in a certain newspaper in Italy. The Adventures of Fiametta.
Had she become addicted to it or something?
She must have been, but she was like a camp follower. Yeah, well, as I say, I was a fully-fledged parachutist then, and we went down to this San Vito de Normani, and we were instructed. There was no differentiation between what officers were and what other ranks were. Everybody lived together, dined together, and all that. There was no officers' mess or anything like that. We just one lot. And I always think we started this again. The wine has been my downfall. We started playing these bloody games, you know. Once they played one there, I always remember, and I got really sozzled in it. What was it? Cardinal Uff or something like that. And every time you had to recite a certain thing, and every time you made a mistake, you had to drink the glass of wine and start at the beginning of the bloody story again to tell it. And once you made another mistake, then you had to start again at the beginning and drink a glass of wine and start to be more glasses of wine. You drank, more mistakes you made. Anyway, this one night we're playing this and all like that, and I started laughing and all like that, and got bloody lockjaw. I couldn't close my mouth. Well, there was supposed to be a doctor there. He was an Egyptian, although he had a British uniform and all kinds of things at British Army. And he said, "I'll mend it," and he put a towel over my head and gave me such a wazzer. He was right, I don't know. I can just about remember it, you know. After that, I passed out. And that was at San Vito de Normani.
Is this Brindisi?
Just outside Brindisi. Yeah, because the airport was at Brindisi that we took off with. And they didn't know much about where we were going or what the conditions were and all that. The only thing that we knew, that we were going to drop into Yugoslavia at a point somewhere near Italy, go into Italy and see how the land lied. We had heard that there were resistance movements and all like that. So we took off from the airport at Brindisi, which is quite near the harbour, as a matter of fact, just up a flight of steps from the harbour, and it was a Halifax bomber. And I can't remember the number of the squadron. I think it was a New Zealand squadron somehow or other. And in those days, inside the Halifax, you were a bit sprawling. You sat on the floor. There were no seats or anything like that. And to get out of the thing with a parachute was the hole in the floor. When you came to the DZ, you all sat there with all sat around the hole with your feet dangling through, you know. Then when the light went, somebody would give you a shove and you're away, you know. Because you didn't want to go on your own. You had to get a shove, you know. And nobody's ever brave at it. So we didn't know what it was, so we took off from there. And to keep ourselves warm in the plane, like parachuting was in its infancy then. There were no reserve chutes like they've got today. You just had one chute. The one thing that I wouldn't have, because I couldn't bloody manage it, I'd tried it before, and that's what they call a leg bag. That was to carry your equipment into a thing strapped onto your leg. And I'd had a bit of trouble with this. I think it was a train's cousin that I wouldn't have one of these. So I said, no, I said, I don't put it in the container. I'll just risk that we'll get it out of the container. Anyway, we had a rubber. The equipment we were given, we could do anything we wanted. We could have any equipment we wanted. We had a choice of arms. Like an idiot, I picked a 45, an automatic 45, and I think it was a Marlin. I think it was American made, 8mm automatic gun. And your uniform, you could have anything you want, so. I had an ordinary uniform, but I took an Australian hat. I think you were on the suggestion of Ed Livingston. He says, create an impression of some way, you know. I took this damn thing. But on the plane, they gave us a K-POC overall to put on. And it was quite thick. We had no such thing as sleeping bag. This was ridiculous. We had a rubber or foam plastic thing round our head. And when they arrived at the dropping zone, the dispatcher, or whatever you want to call him, he came down and said, right, we're there now, more or less, shouting, because it was terrific, roaring the plane. It's not like flying in a jumbo jet or anything like that. Terrific noise and stuff flapping around inside. And we all sat with our legs in the hole there, and then it's get ready, you know, and then the green light on away. The greatest thing, we were supposed to, they said, you'll be dropping about 600 feet. You'll be about 600 feet. I got out of that plane, and one moment you've got the rushing of the plane, terrific, you know, deafening noise. The next minute, perfectly quiet. It was a moonlight night, and in the distance, I put this in the in that booklet that I wrote, that you could see everything. You could pick everything out. All the rivers, they were like silver capes, you know. And there were one of them, a massive river there below. And that was the Isonzo that divided more or less Italy from Slovenia, where all the trouble is at present. And we landed in Slovenia in a place called Cipavano, the Valley of Cipavano.
When would this have been?
That was about May in 1944.
Who went with you?
Edley Vincent, known as Tucker, Mac Donnell, and myself, just the three of us.
T-U-C-K-E-R?
Tucker, yeah, Tommy Tucker. Why you call yourself that, I don't know.
What was the operation called?
The operation was called Sermon.
How do you spell it?
Like a Sunday sermon. S-E-R-M-O-N. Sermon. Anyway, we landed, and all that area, it's proper alpine doing, alpine trees, and it's a bit alarming too. You know, with those old parachutes that we had then, I think they were 28 footers or something, if I can remember rightly. You don't have much control. When I see these red devils and all like that coming down and landing on a sixpence, well, you know, fantastic. With this, you didn't have any control at all. And you came down like a ton of bricks. And especially if you like either going forward, the wind's taking you forward, or sideways or something like that. It's a bit alarming to go whizzing through blinking fir trees, you know, at about 30 mile an hour, expecting one to meet you head on, you know. Anyway, we managed to get down the parachute on the thing, and the next thing is, like, who are they? Who could I hear coming up the hillside, you know? You're frightened of answering, you know, you don't know. You don't know who it is. So you keep doggo, and then you hear somebody English gear, something like that, and you're still a little bit of alarm. And eventually you say, well, mucker nettles, like, you know, come out mucker nettles. It's an expression, it's a Lancashire expression, well, you know.
What does it mean?
It means, well, You're in it up to your neck, you might as well go the whole log, you know. So it came out, and these red tags, as they were, came over and welcomed you, took you to the nearest bit of a house, and gave you a glass of something that was like, it was clear, it looked like water, but it didn't taste like water. And I learned later it went under the name of Rakia. So then they collected all the stuff. Most of the stuff was for them, for the Yugoslavs. And I think they've been told that certain canisters marked a certain way belonged to us. And they took us up into the hills, up into more or less a house at the top of the hills there. Far end of the village of Lokve, L-O-K-V-E. That's how we're village. As a matter of fact, I was there this April. And these people that had these houses, you know, that we went into, were really frightened about us staying there. Because the Germans knew everywhere where the partisans, the resistance people, and all like that were living. And the first opportunity when they came up was to burn the houses down. We were very, very careful. At that time I did smoke. about throwing fag ends down. You had to be careful what kind of a fag end. You know, you can throw something that had craven air on or something like that, a capstan, you know. That was paid to the people there. And in the next house, there was a Russian mission. There was a couple of Russian officers. And in the house further on, although we didn't have much dealings with them, there was another English officer called Deakin, who I believe was one of the great British military missions of Yugoslavia, Deakin.
This is Bill Deakin.
Must be Bill Deakin. I don't know if I don't know it's Deakin. And what surprised me there was that with the Yugoslavs, there were the officers of the Tito's army. They were well dressed. They had British uniforms that had been pulled to pieces and remade into their own design of a Yugoslav army uniform. But it would probably take about three British uniforms to make that. And yet, they're ordinary blokes, or some of them without shoes. You know, without proper trousers on them. The breeches are hanging out, as I would say, in my own expression, you know. Poor blokes, you know. The Yugoslavs are the partisans, the Yugoslav partisans. They must have been. It's hard to say, you know, what they put up with. What they put up with. No food, no nothing. And the worst ones, which I saw one day coming through there, was like a, they call them battalion, but it wouldn't be. It'd be about 40 men marching through. And what they were Italians that had volunteered to go into the partisan army. Now, you understand the Italians were on the other side. And these blokes had volunteered to join. And believe you me, they didn't have to treat them rough. But they kept with them and they fought with them and all that. But it was no picnic. They had no shoes. They were both walking without shoes, you know. And I don't know. You talk about being not having anything to eat, not having anything to eat. You don't just go thin. You have a queer colour about yourself. You have an ashen. It's hard to explain. It looks like your face has been dusted with some grey dust. You know, and they all have this look. You know. But they got something to eat. There's no spoon, no nothing to eat with, you know. Best they can out of the container, you know, and then the finger in, licking it up and all like that, you know. They really suffered, did these people. Really suffered. As I told you tonight, you know, like within Yugoslavia itself. They weren't just fighting the Germans. They were fighting themselves. It was civil war. As I told you, there were the communists, the Czechniks.